I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Arianna Brocious.
And this is Climate One.
Keep it in the ground, let's keep it in the ground. Keep it in the ground, let's keep it in the ground.
Keep it in the ground. It means stop extracting oil, gas, and coal. It's the opposite of drill, baby, drill.
And there's real truth to it. There is no way we can stay under the emissions target set by the Paris Accord if we burn through all the oil and gas that's already planned to be developed and sold. And we know that doing that is kind of like intentionally setting our homes on fire because of all the planet-warming emissions it will add to the atmosphere.
Yet, if you're a petrostate or a company or a community that relies on taxes those companies pay, leaving fossil fuels in the ground means leaving trillions of dollars in the ground. How's that going to happen when so many people depend on it?
But there is an effort to actually get this done. There's a growing movement of countries pushing for fossil fuel non-proliferation, and they're trying to pressure other countries to join them. We'll hear about that in this week's show.
Everyone sees the age of oil sunsetting. Even Saudi Arabia's former oil minister often said the Stone Age didn't end for a lack of stones, and the oil age won't end for a lack of oil. And yet, every oil-producing country wants to continue drilling for as long as possible to hold on to this extremely lucrative industry. For a country to go against their own economic self-interest is truly remarkable.
Ecuador is home to part of the Amazon rainforest, and underneath it, oil-rich land. Last August, the country held a national referendum to stop drilling and leave a bunch of that oil in the ground. And the people voted in favor of the move. What brought the Ecuadorian people to this point is an intricate and fascinating tale, and that's what we're going to unpack for you now. Kevin Koenig is with Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that works to protect the rainforest and advance the rights of indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. He also spent a number of years working within the Ecuadorian government. As he told me, oil hasn't been the golden ticket that people initially hoped for. And the industry has left a lot of environmental destruction and pollution in its wake. The story begins 80 years ago.
Oil was first discovered in Ecuador in the 1940s by Shell Oil, but it was in remote areas of the Amazon and they were unable to sort of get it out of the ground and get it to market. But then in the late 1960s, Texaco came into the northern part of the Ecuadorian Amazon and began to drill for oil. And it was a big thing for the country. The first barrel of oil that came out of the ground in an area known as Lago Agrio was taken to Quito. It was given its own parade. It was blessed by the Archdiocese of Ecuador. And it was really seen as the ticket to, you know, quote unquote, the developing world for Ecuador, right? Oil, it was a new era in Ecuador. It was going to be the panacea that would bring Ecuador out of poverty and basically alleviate, you know, all the ills of Ecuador. And in fact, the opposite happened.
Right. So during three decades of oil extraction, Texaco, which was later acquired by Chevron, created an ecological and public health disaster, dumping millions of gallons of toxic wastewater and oil into the Amazon. How did that affect the country's view of oil?
During this time, basically, what you had was Texaco operating and really just, you know, drilling and dumping, right, for decades. And people were getting sick. Rainforests were being deforested. Oil flares burning 24/7 all throughout the northern Ecuadorian Amazon. And local communities were, you know, bearing the brunt of the extraction, saw their rivers turn black. All of the area that they were operating in was and still is indigenous territory of five indigenous nations who were, you know, using rivers to fish, to drink, to bathe, to wash clothes. And so they were living amongst oil infrastructure and spills. People saw for the first time the impact of industry in a place like the Amazon. Meanwhile, in other parts of the country, I think questions began to arise because poverty continued. It was not. People began to talk about the resource curse, right? And is this plethora of oil actually leading to more debt and dependency?
Right. I mean, the profits from a company like Texaco or Chevron are not generally given to the country where they're doing the exploration. I mean, there's probably some percentage, but a lot of it's being exported. So Ecuador's economy is heavily dependent on oil, has been for a while. It's one of the top South American oil producers. But in those decades, in the last half century, has oil and those profits helped the country advance in a meaningful way that reflects in the life of an average citizen?
During those decades, I think what happened was the oil wealth really became a sort of misnomer, right? Because this is where we started to see high levels of corruption happening, right? And also during a chunk of that time, there was a military dictatorship. So the economic benefit of the oil industry was not coming down to local people. It was being concentrated in the hands of companies and government. Also during this time, you had other international financial institutions like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, who, because Ecuador now had discovered oil and was producing oil, were very eager to extend lines of credit to Ecuador. And so what you started to have happen was loans, a lot of borrowing. And then, of course, when the price of oil changes, like a commodity like that that fluctuates and the price bottoms out, the economy of Ecuador that depends on this oil revenue tanks, basically. And so that's what sort of caught the country in this cycle of debt and dependency, where borrowing and borrowing and borrowing has, you could argue, left them poorer than when the oil boom began.
Right. So you were brought on in 2008 into the Ecuadorian government to help with a proposal spearheaded by former President Rafael Correa, who wanted to maybe change the equation, right? And sort of see if the international community would support Ecuador in keeping that some of that oil in the ground, right? Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So in 2007, when Rafael Correa came into power, and he's sort of a self-defined, leftist, progressive, his administration was filled with a lot of people from civil society. And they were really, I think, thinking outside of the box, right? And Rafael Correa, before he became president, he was economic minister with a different administration. And he was looking at this issue of the connection between oil and debt. And so when he came into power, he, I think, was very eager to think about different ways in which Ecuador could get off of oil. And so the proposal that was put out to the world was also sort of based on this idea of ecological debt, right? And some of the climate conferences and the principle of shared but differentiated responsibility, where Ecuador as a country has not contributed in a significant way to the climate crisis. Meanwhile, northern countries bear the historic responsibility for the climate change problem. So a lot of the proposal to keep fossil fuels in the ground in the ITT fields and ask for international collaboration from northern countries was based on that idea.
And the ITT fields is just the name given to these particular oil fields in this Yasuni National Park, right?
Yeah. So the area of the Yasuni that we're talking about are three oil fields, the Ishpingo, Tambococha, Tiputini fields. And they are one of Ecuador's largest oil fields, right? It's about 800 million barrels of oil. So it's significant reserves. So at the time in 2007, this is a big deal. It is very much a revolutionary idea at the time. No other nation had proposed that, saying we're going to keep one of our largest oil fields in the ground if the world can step up and help offset our foregone revenue.
And so this proposal was floated to the international community, and basically nobody wanted to participate, right? There was not enough willingness on the part of the U.S., other countries, to compensate Ecuador in exchange for not developing these oil fields, right?
Right. It was put out to the world, and quite honestly, the response was crickets, more or less. It's important to understand, too, at this time, politically, what was happening in Latin America. You had, Correa, a leftist. You had Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. You had Evo Morales in Bolivia. And they were dubbed by politicians and media as the Latin American axis of evil, right? And so the proposal was really seen as almost a ransom. Mm. Like Correa was saying, hey, northern countries, give me money or the forest gets it, which is really unfortunate, because fast forward to where we are now. I mean, now there's been multiple reports from the International Energy Agency, among others, saying, look, we need to keep 2/3 of fossil fuels in the ground. The world, we need a rapid transition away from fossil fuels. But those reports hadn't come out yet. Right. So the proposal from Korea was really an outlier at the time.
So what's so fascinating is that this proposal to the international community fails. But then it sort of changes shape and becomes a national referendum to do this without compensation from other countries. And so last year, Ecuadorians voted in favor of stopping development of new oil wells in this part of the Yasuni National Park, which is a UNESCO biosphere reserve, keeping around what I have, 726 million barrels of oil underground, does not block drilling in the whole park, just this part of it. How did that referendum come out of this effort from the former president?
Right. The proposal of the government was widely popular in Ecuador. I mean, the polling was showing that 90% of the population was in favor of this new thinking that they could keep fossil fuels in the ground and still have some revenue for their economy. And so Correa in 2013 says, look, the world hasn't stepped up. We didn't get the money we needed, and we're gonna drill there. So in 2013, he announces plans to begin extraction of these oil fields. And the reaction from civil society was swift and strong. I mean, protests erupted around the country in the capital city of Quito, and they began to organize. And a collective was formed called Yasunidos, and they began to collect signatures throughout the country. A couple of years later, they had, you know, obtained 800,000 plus signatures, more than double the amount needed to qualify for a referendum. Unfortunately, though, this is where some questionable electoral practices and maybe just outright corruption began, because in the counting of these signatures and the validation process, the Correa administration basically threw out more than half, leaving it just short of how many signatures were needed for a referendum. Community organizers then took the administration to court and challenged that. That case took almost 10 years to wind its way through the court system until finally, a little over a year ago, the Constitutional Court found that indeed the signatures were valid. There were enough to qualify for a referendum, and that this question of whether or not Ecuadorians were in favor of keeping fossil fuels in the ground in IDT fields, that would go to a vote. However, importantly, what has changed since, you know, that decade, while the case wound its way through the courts, oil drilling began. And so you now had a situation where there was more than 200 wells that were in production in the ITT fields. Roads had been constructed, and there are plans to build up to 600 more wells. So fast forward to last August when the vote happens. They're basically asking voters to say, you know, are you in favor of keeping this in the ground? And that means not extracting anything new, but it also means dismantling and decommissioning that existing production that is currently underway.
Which is a bigger endeavor than never doing it in the first place. So this is such an interesting case for so many reasons, but I want to point out the fact to an American audience. So this is a national referendum, a national vote, for activity that would only take part in one corner of the country. So it'd be almost like if Americans were voting collectively on whether or not to allow oil drilling in part of Texas or something. And we hear elsewhere in this episode that some locals who depend on the oil industry aren't thrilled about the decision. That two provinces where the vote didn't pass were the two main oil producing regions of Ecuador. So though it did pass nationally, and as it sounds like there's a lot of favor in some of the more larger cities, what's been the sense among people about the result of the vote?
I think to a certain extent, the vote speaks for itself in that, you know, it won with 59%, right? It's not quite a landslide, but it was not, you know, it didn't just squeak by, right? This is a large percentage of the population that is in agreement with keeping fossil fuels in the ground there. I think a lot of that vote stems from the contamination that has been so associated in those decades, that toxic legacy of the industry in the country, and people really not buying this myth that oil extraction is the key to development in the future of Ecuador. Certainly in those two provinces, that is where the oil industry began. This is where the first Texaco work camp began, and then the industry is built up tremendously in those two provinces. It's ground zero for oil companies and oil servicing companies and all the industry that sort of supports the extraction process. So It's not surprising that this question in the referendum might not have passed in those two provinces, but at the end of the day, it is a national referendum, right? And so I think it does speak to this question of, as Ecuador moves away from oil extraction, what does a just transition look like for workers and communities that are dependent on the industry?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the area, this Yasuni National Park, is inhabited by indigenous people, a few different groups. Where do they fall in the vote, if you have a sense? What is their experience with the oil industry, and are they supportive of keeping it in the ground?
Yeah, so Yasuni National Park is the ancestral territory of the Huarani indigenous peoples. And there are also two Huarani clans, which are the Tagaeri and Taramanani, which are living in voluntary isolation, right? And that is an important component of this whole conversation. And I think it was a big motivator as well why the referendum question won so handily, because oil extraction in that area is, you know, it is a death sentence for people living in voluntary isolation, right? To be having tractors and oil infrastructure built in areas that they are using. They're nomadic, right? This is their traditional areas for their hunting grounds, where they're gathering food, is being turned into an oil field. And so if drilling were to continue, that's an existential threat for them. So I think that was a big part of what voters in the country were raising concerns about. The Huarani, their federation has been supportive, and they just came out this week as well with publicly pressuring the current government in Ecuador to comply with this referendum and to keep these oil fields permanently in the ground. There are some communities, right, that have been affected by drilling in other areas of the park that have signed agreements with different oil companies over the years. And I think there we have sort of seen a cycle of oil companies that are extracting billions of dollars worth of oil, and what is provided to local communities, I think, can be characterized as trinkets and beads. And you have communities that have become entirely dependent on oil companies for basic services, like clean water, for example, which speaks to the fact that, you know, if the industry is having such an impact on the ecosystems and water systems of local communities that they have to provide bottled fresh water for local communities, that's a problem.
We'll pick up our conversation with Kevin Koenig of Amazon Watch after a quick break. Also coming up, we'll hear from Ecuadorians themselves about the vote to keep oil in the ground and protect their environment. Not everyone supported the move.
Well, I voted no because I benefit from it.
That's up next when Climate One continues. We'll be right back.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets if you win. That's $300 in bonus bets if you win your first $5 bet. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Today we're hearing about Ecuador's efforts to leave some of its oil in the ground. A controversial idea, but one that climate scientists say is necessary if we want to avoid the most catastrophic effects of a hotter climate. Let's get back to my conversation with Kevin Koenig of Amazon Watch. Crude oil is Ecuador's most important export. So I asked him, if the country stops production on these wells in the Amazon, what would be the impact?
Ecuador is heavily dependent on oil revenues, right? It's about a third of their export revenue. And I think it's about 6% of their GDP. So it plays a big role. Right now, the production from this area is about 72,000 barrels per day. So it's significant. And I think what is at play here, though, is these fields are going to be retired prematurely. So there is a significant economic toll that it would take on the country of Ecuador, but there are other economic alternatives for the country where this revenue could potentially be replaced or augmented in different ways.
most domestic oil production is now run by the state-owned Petroecuador, right? What does the current administration feel about this requirement now to stop production, remove the infrastructure? What does that mean in terms of shutting down these wells? How likely are they to comply?
Sure. Since the referendum passed last August 2023, the administration of current President Daniel Noboa, they are certainly dragging their feet. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the administration, together with Petroecuador, have been doing everything they can to delay implementing this and citing the economic toll to the country, the economic cost of decommissioning these wells and dismantling infrastructure and repairing and remediating areas where extraction has been happening. So there is real concern that the government is, in the short term, not going to comply with this. Once the referendum was passed, the Constitutional Court gave the government a year to comply. And only recently have they even produced a first plan of what this is going to look like. But they're talking about, you know, it will take them 7 to 10 years to actually implement this. But 7 to 10 years, again, the question of biodiversity, of indigenous rights, of isolated peoples, they can't wait.
Yeah, right. I'm curious where the discussion of climate change and concerns around that in particular come into this discussion for sort of regular Ecuadorians, people who voted on the referendum. What about climate disruption? Is that part of how people were weighing this vote?
Absolutely. I think the climate question was also central to the way people voted. I mean, Ecuador is like a lot of other places in South America, and particularly the Amazon region of Ecuador, is already seeing the impacts of climate change, from extreme drought to extreme historic flooding to hail the size of softballs falling in the Amazon. And it's become very obvious, though, that they also don't have a lot of the resources to adapt or mitigate the impact that they're seeing. And I think the climate justice issue was a big part of why you saw, you know, major, you know, movement from youth across Ecuador and indigenous youth, and really kind of raising this question, saying, look, Ecuador bears so little of the responsibility historically for climate change crisis, but is on the front lines and bearing burden of the tremendous impacts of climate change. And I think that there's a new generation that are really, you know, behind what I think is it's a vote for hope, honestly. I think they're saying Ecuador can lead the world. You know, if oil can be kept in the ground by a country that is so heavily dependent on oil revenues, then why can't the United States or Canada or Norway or some of these other big producers do it?
Yeah, that's a great framing. So we know Colombia signed on to the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty. What's the potential for this kind of action to expand to other parts of the Amazon, maybe within Ecuador or other countries that are part of the Amazon, or other parts of the world?
The referendum vote in Ecuador, I think, does really have the potential to be replicated. And obviously, there are different routes to get to this conclusion of keeping fossil fuels in the ground. It can be by a referendum vote. It can be by legislation or executive orders, or there's many different pathways. Citizens can pressure their leaders to make this happen. In the case of Colombia, they're leading the charge and saying very vocally that we are committing to nothing new, no new expansion, no new exploration. The Amazon as an ecosystem, as a biome, is at a very, very dangerous tipping point, where it's facing ecological collapse if forest degradation and deforestation continues. And so I think there is a general rising awareness of Amazonian countries that this tipping point is very real, and it's going to impact people who live in the Amazon, but will have bigger implications for our climate.
Kevin Koenig is Climate, Energy, and Extractive Industry Director at Amazon Watch. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The referendum to stop drilling in part of Ecuador's Amazon rainforest passed about a year ago. We wanted to know more about what average Ecuadorians think about this vote, especially in the provinces where drilling is happening. Mateo Schimpf of our sister podcast On Shifting Ground brings us this story.
The vote in favor of the referendum to keep oil in the ground, it surprised a lot of people. And it sparked immediate reaction.
A lot of people from the oil industry started speaking up right away. It said, like, this can't happen. The country's gonna go to hell. Oil has been a savior for us, and Ecuador can't afford this.
That's Kimberly Brown.
I'm a freelance journalist based in Quito, Ecuador.
For the past 2 years, Kimberly's been covering the Keep It In The Ground campaign and the referendum vote that followed. Oil's been a linchpin of the country's economy for decades. But many urban and rural Ecuadorians, they disagree about what should happen next. To find out how people living near the oil wells in question are feeling about the vote, Kimberly ventured into the Amazon. It's a long way from Quito. 8 hours by bus to the edge of Yasuni National Park, and then another 5 by boat up the Napo River. Her guide is Homer Machoa, and the two are headed to Yanchama. It's an indigenous Quechua community just a few miles from an oil field affected by the referendum.
So then how close is the closest oil well to the village? Is it far from here or what?
Yes, from our spot, we're 9 kilometers from the wells.
In 2023, Homer was part of the Yasunidos campaign. That was a grassroots effort that pushed the issue of stopping oil production in Yasuni to a national vote.
Voting yes to stop it was because we've seen how the oil companies have affected people, how people have suffered from diseases, how people have had to drink contaminated water.
Homer's a young guy, in his early 30s, but he's already spent time working in local government and with Ecuador's Ministry of the Environment. Those were both eye-opening experiences for him, and they stoked his fears about just how much power the oil industry has in Ecuador.
When he was working as a park guard for the Ministry of Environment, he was telling me at one point they saw huge streams of smoke coming out of one of the oil wells.
One time, we parked there at the production center, and suddenly, I don't know what happened, but suddenly the gas started coming up. A huge flame. We wanted to go because if we are from the Ministry of the Environment, we have the right and the obligation to go and see if there was a spill or something. But they didn't allow us. The company is always above the Ministry of the Environment.
So he thought that was not right, that the private company has more say than the Ministry of Environment in who has access to the Amazon and who gets to monitor things. And so he said he quit after that moment.
Homer says that over the years, those oil companies have spent a lot of time courting local residents to allow development on community land. But once the ink dries on a contract, the oil companies and their financial support, they disappear. To Homer, it feels like deception. Like many who voted yes on the referendum, he questions whether oil companies will ever deliver on their promise to surrounding communities.
When I was going around during the campaign, I would say, understand it's been 10 years. How many people are working in the company? What benefits have we seen from them? So most have said, we don't have healthcare attention. There's nothing in terms of social assistance, even worse in infrastructure.
Hola, señora. Hola, ¿puedo entrar?
But others remember back to 2014, when oil reps handed out $3,000 in cash to each resident of the community.
Well, I voted no because I benefit from it.
That's Magdalena Cordoba. Magdalena's two sons are the only people in Yanchama who still have jobs in the oil industry.
We can buy machines, for example, a motor, a generator, buy materials to build a house, or a wheelbarrow with the money they earn from working.
Magdalena often wonders whether Ecuadorians who voted yes on the referendum were actually thinking about the people who live near the oil wells.
Claro que somos explotados, sí.
Of course, we are exploited, yes, but the little I have has served me. The people in the city, They live peacefully. They get what they want.
The divisions, though, they aren't just between rural and urban Ecuadorians. Like a lot of people who live in poor but ecologically diverse parts of the world, Holmer is making a go of environmental tourism. From a practical standpoint, it makes sense. But the way Magdalena sees it, if Holmer is making money off of bringing tourists to Yanchima, then everyone in the community should get a cut.
El Holmer, él quiere solo para él.
He only wants it for himself. That's why people here don't like Holmer. They don't want him to be a guide because Torrance is a community-based. It's for everyone.
Kimberly said that these kinds of local politics are a big reason that ecotourism hasn't made headway in Yanchima.
They do want to live off the rainforest, but they also want to not live in poverty.
On her way back to Quito, Kimberly passes through Coca. It's a cement city founded on the oil industry.
Coca itself is a city of about 50,000 people. It's a small city, but it's also considered the gateway to the Amazon.
People from surrounding provinces flocked there in the early 2000s to service platform and pipeline and ship workers who were moving crude oil from Yasuni to refineries on Ecuador's coast.
But that was maybe 20 years ago. When I was talking to people, they still talk about the importance of the oil industry for all of their businesses, but they also said, like, people don't come through here anymore. We needed to come back.
Mercedes Angora is the manager of Hotel La Misión. She says that during the region's oil boom, hotels and restaurants in Coca were packed with workers. As recently as 2014, La Misión had 40 employees.
And how many people are there now?
Habemos tres.
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 Three. We have three. I'm here. There's the pool attendant and there's the guard. There's no one else.
And are you worried that if they start closing the oil wells in the jungle, well, would that worry you in a way?
Of course, because at least a lot of people come here for the boats. At least the dock is rented. They would have to close the dock. There would be no passage through here anymore. That would be stopped. But let's hope that doesn't happen.
After covering the referendum for more than a year, Kimberly's heard all sorts of reasons for why people are against it. But what's most interesting is the way that people feel like the referendum is already affecting them.
Some people were falsely saying that now the oil blocks have closed and there's no business. And that's actually false because those particular oil blocks in the referendum have not closed.
The reality is that once they'd finished building the oil infrastructure, the industry no longer needed all those workers who used to eat and sleep and party in places like Coca. When Ecuador's Constitutional Court officially recognized the referendum's passage, it gave the government 1 year to make a plan for decommissioning the extraction site in Yasuni National Park. But for the past 6 months, Ecuador's military and police have been caught in a bloody and expensive war with the country's gangs. President Daniel Noboa, who's previously said that the country didn't really need the oil from Yasuni, now can't afford to lose it. In January, he put a moratorium on the Yasuni referendum. That means, for at least one more year, oil production will continue. When and if the moratorium does lift, the clock will restart on a plan to phase out extraction in this part of Yasuni. But Kimberly said her biggest concern is for what comes after that.
I think people who have more concrete alternatives need to be working more closely with the government to make those actual plans and put them into action. There is kind of an illness here where every time a new government comes into office, they like wipe the slate clean from the government before and start everything new. And that's a problem in making any kind of alternative economy happen.
If you want to check out more of Kimberly's reporting, you can head to KimberlyJBrown.com. For Climate One and On Shifting Ground, I'm Mateo Schimpf.
If you want to know more about Ecuador's long and complicated legal case with Texaco over the company's environmental destruction in the Amazon, I highly recommend the podcast Drilled by our friend Amy Westervelt. Season 5 is all about the case.
Coming up, 50 years ago, the nations of the world came together with a non-proliferation treaty to halt the production of nuclear weapons. As our climate crisis deepens, could we do the same thing for fossil fuels?
We currently have enough fossil fuels to take the world well past 2 degrees. So anything that we dig up now are additional fossil fuels that we actually can't afford to burn.
We'll be right back.
Imagine a world-class graduate education that's accessible, flexible, and designed for career impact. That's Harvard Extension School. Build actionable knowledge and skills in challenging online classes taught by Harvard faculty and industry experts. Explore new opportunities and expand your network with high-achieving professionals from around the world. Part-time learning, real-world impact. This is Harvard, on your terms. Learn more at extension.harvard.edu/Spotify.
Countries around the world are becoming more serious about reducing carbon emissions to meet international targets. At the same time, many of those same countries, including the United States, are still approving new oil and gas projects, committing us to more deadly fires, floods, and heat. The global economy still runs on fossil fuels, and the profits are just too good to pass up. And yet, a small but growing number of countries are taking a stand to leave those future emissions in the ground at the expense of their own revenues. I talked about that with Zipporah Berman, chair of a global nonprofit aimed at creating a binding international agreement.
The Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty is an initiative that is designed to ensure greater international cooperation between nation states to curb the expansion of fossil fuels, the production of fossil fuels, because to date, we have had climate policy and international agreements that focus on emissions or pollution, countries agreeing how much they will pollute, negotiating on the space left in the atmosphere. And we haven't had any agreements on who gets to produce and how much. And so this treaty is designed to provide new global governance around the production of fossil fuels, to align the production of fossil fuels with a global carbon budget and our climate goals.
And the term nonproliferation immediately brings to mind nuclear weapons. I worked in nuclear arms control earlier in my career. So how does this treaty model some of the goals of nuclear disarmament and arms reductions, really?
We took part of our inspiration from the campaigns on nuclear nonproliferation. And the analogy is definitely on purpose, because like with nuclear weapons, right now on fossil fuel production, no country wants to unilaterally disarm. We have enough. You know, when I grew up in the nuclear arms era, when the realization dawned that we had enough nuclear weapons to blow up the planet 6 times over. Well, we currently have enough fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, either on the surface of the planet or already under construction, to take the world well past 2 degrees. So anything that we dig up now, any new projects are additional fossil fuels that we actually can't afford to burn if we want to meet our climate goals, if we want to ensure climate safety and to ensure that big swaths of the planet are not uninhabitable. And so the idea of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty is a recognition that we need to stop stockpiling and that countries are going to need to cooperate to constrain what are today's weapons of mass destruction. And I know that that is quite a controversial statement to say, because we're all still dependent on fossil fuels. And to a certain extent,
they do a lot of good in our daily lives. Nuclear weapons never did me any good. Fossil fuels have done me a lot of good. Well, you might debate nuclear weapons kept us safe.
Well, that was the idea. And that's kind of the second parallel, is that there was a time when people thought nuclear weapons were what kept us safe. And there still is a lot of people who think that more fossil fuels are what will bring us prosperity, because that's where we were. And they have. Fossil fuels have brought us prosperity. But now we have alternatives to the majority of uses of fossil fuels. And today we know. We know what we didn't know before. We know that fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, are 86%. Those three products account for 86% of the emissions that are trapped in our atmosphere, creating a blanket smothering the earth and the extreme weather, the floods, the fires, and the increase in all of that. But we also know that fossil fuels are the greatest cause of premature death on the planet, from air pollution, from asthma, let alone the heat waves. These are toxic products. And it's only in the accumulative use over decades that we've begun to realize we're poisoning our bodies, our air, our water, and also threatening a stable climate with their use. And so now we need to transition. But what really inspired me to create the Fossil Fuel Treaty is the idea that this strange kind of groupthink that we have going on, that we're in a transition, but we can just keep growing the problem. We're on track today to produce 110% more oil, gas, and coal than we can ever burn under a 2-degree world. So why are we putting all of our financial and intellectual and political effort into digging up more stuff that we know we can't use?
You now have 12 signatory countries. What does signing compel them to do?
What they're doing is endorsing the concept. And again, similar to other treaties, nuclear nonproliferation, chemical weapons ban, landmines, we're building a group of countries that are committed to the concept. So these countries have said, we endorse the idea of the Fossil Fuel Treaty. We want to be the countries that start creating the rules and global governance around constraining the production of fossil fuels in an equitable way. And they are committing to work together to with diplomats and lawyers and scientists from around the world that we've pulled together in the initiative to design the treaty, but also to reach out to other nation states and get them to join the treaty as well.
And with nuclear arms, it was really Russia and the U.S., that Soviet Union and the U.S., the two biggest holders and producers came together to lead. Now, in this case, you're kind of starting, I don't know if you call it from the bottom up, with smaller producers. How many fossil fuel producers do you think you need to get together to really compel the action of the largest producers, US, Canada, Saudi Arabia?
What you really need to create a negotiating mandate on a treaty is to have representatives from many regions of the world, to have a core group of countries. It's a misnomer to think that we need 190 countries and they have to agree by consensus. You know, that's the design of the current climate change negotiations. That wasn't the design of chemical weapons bans, of landmine treaties. What we need is probably another 8 to 10 countries to get a formal negotiating mandate. We now have Colombia, which is one of the largest coal exporters in the world, having a country that produces fossil fuels say, we recognize that we all need to stop expanding the production of fossil fuels, but we can't do it without greater international cooperation. That was a tipping point last year at Dubai, and now other countries are starting to discuss engaging and endorsing the treaty. So I think by the end of the year, we'll likely have 20 countries and we'll start designing the treaty.
In nuclear weapons, there was also citizen diplomacy. There were cities that declared themselves nuclear-free zones. Is there also sort of a city and state-level pathway to engage in this other than nation states?
There is, and in fact, it's growing very fast. We now have over 100 cities from around the world, from LA to Vancouver to Calcutta, who have passed motions at city councils endorsing the treaty. And increasingly, we have states. Hawaii was the first state actually to endorse. And recently, California passed motions in the Senate and in the House. And that momentum is really critical for really pushing nation states to consider a new fossil fuel treaty as a companion to the Paris Agreement. We also have a movement of organizations around the world. 2,700 organizations from around the world in 117 countries have endorsed, 3,000 scientists and 101 Nobel laureates, faith groups and health groups around the world. It's really becoming a movement for the fossil fuel treaty, and really anyone can join and anyone can start running initiatives and campaigns. And that's what we're starting to see around the world.
For a church or a scientist who's not involved in producing fossil fuel to say that. It's another thing for the state of California, which is a big fossil fuel producer, to say they're going to leave some money in the ground.
Exactly. And one of the fifth largest economies. And imagine if under the treaty, we were able to create agreements between those who had endorsed not just agreements about not doing something, but also about what they do do. One of the things we're looking at right now under a treaty is, what if a jurisdiction who is endorsed says, we're still going to be buying some fossil fuels between now and 2050. We're only going to buy from other treaty nation states.
Elsewhere in this episode, we hear about the national referendum vote in Ecuador to keep a certain amount of oil in the ground in the Amazon and the Yasuni National Park. How meaningful is that? And are you concerned it might be able to be undone?
It is incredibly meaningful, especially to those indigenous nations whose territory is being destroyed and poisoned, who still depend on those rainforests. But it's incredibly important to all of us. I mean, the Amazon is critical to all of our survival, to hydrological stability, to climate stability, biodiversity stability. The idea that we're still drilling for new oil in the heart of the Amazon is humanity's stupid test right now. And so, sure, it's an incredibly important referendum. But until the systemic causes are changed, I mean, Ecuador is drilling for new oil in the heart of the Amazon just to feed its debt. In fact, it's a debt for oil swap with China. So part of what we're looking at under the fossil fuel treaty is debt forgiveness to keep carbon in the ground. We do this all the time, right? Well, keeping humanity safe and actually keeping the amount of carbon in the ground that is for years already been said by the science is critical if we're going to maintain a stable planet, that should be considered in debt agreements, in trade agreements, and in tax agreements.
Right. President Biden has done more to address climate than any U.S. president, and the U.S. is producing record amounts of fossil fuels. Both things are true. Mm-hmm. Of course, the increase in production started under Obama. It's due to fracking more than government policy, really. How do you see those two truths of peak production and more climate action?
Yeah, this is exactly what happened in my own country. I'm Canadian. And when I started this work, it was because of my work in the tar sands in Alberta, really understanding that we could have a new prime minister and at the time a new premier in Alberta that was committed to climate action. I believe the Biden administration is committed to climate action. I agree with you about the IRA. It's significant. But again, it focuses on pollution reduction, emissions reduction, reducing the demand for fossil fuels while just allowing the production to grow. Again, what we build today will be what we use tomorrow. And the idea that the Biden administration is saying they're in line with the science and their climate leaders while completely ignoring the part of the science from the International Energy Agency, from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that says no new projects fit under our climate policy, under net zero agreements or under our agreements under the Paris Agreement. So they keep building more and saying that's okay because everybody has a right to produce. Well, if every country and every company is saying, yes, the world's going to use less, but it might as well be ours, so we're okay to continue expanding, then we've got a problem.
What would you say to people that constraining fossil fuel supply, if you're really successful, will spike prices, and then you have yellow jackets in France, you have cranky voters who vote out climate-friendly politicians?
It's a really important point because we can't look at the infrastructure that we need to build and the modeling as though politics and culture don't exist. And so I agree that that's a really critical point. But two things. First of all, this idea that we have to allow the markets to function, that our job is to maintain stable markets. Our job is to maintain a livable planet and to save as many lives as we can right now. And there have been many times throughout history when governments have intervened to ensure a managed decline of a product, to regulate the markets. And that's what we're suggesting has to happen now. The fact is that the fossil fuel industry will decline over time because we're seeing the uptake of new technologies and EVs and battery storage, the drop in the price of renewable energy. But right now, the markets are distorted. They're distorted by about $13 million of fossil fuel subsidies a minute, according to the IMF. So massive amounts of fossil fuel subsidies distort the market right now. But to your point about price, I think it's a really critical point. If we do this well, then we're constraining demand, reducing the demand for fossil fuels by giving people and ensuring that everyone has access to solutions. You don't need to buy gas for your car if you have accessible public transit, if electric cars are subsidized, etc., you don't need to buy more fossil fuels to heat your home if you can get heat pumps and that everyone has access to that, whether you're wealthy or not. If energy efficiency programs and retrofits and insulation are available to people. So if we ensure good programs to reduce demand and pollution and our dependence on fossil fuels, at the same time constraining their production, then yeah, the price may go up, but we'll need less of it.
Right. And you fought against 6 pipelines, and at some point you realized you needed a different approach. How did that realization come about that maybe you were playing a game of whack-a-mole?
Well, it was from the experience of playing the game of whack-a-mole. I mean, I spent over 10 years working on pipeline campaigns from Enbridge to Energy East to Keystone, Trans Mountain. And every time we were able to slow down or stop a new piece of fossil fuel infrastructure. And these pipelines were essential for growing the size of the tar sands, which is one of the highest carbon intensive and dirtiest oil projects on Earth. Every time we were successful, the industry would just propose a new one. They have a lot of money, right? And that money makes sure that they have a significant influence in policy, but also that they can just continue to propose and make cases for new projects.
You know, stopping Keystone doesn't change demand. This is the debate I always have with my friends who are advocates who feel like, you know, stopping Keystone was a win. It didn't change demand at all.
Well, what stopping Keystone did is it decreased the potential of the expansion of one of the biggest pools of carbon on Earth under Alberta, the Alberta tar sands.
So maybe the oil then comes from a cleaner place somewhere else.
And that idea that if you reduce one project, the demand stays the same or the amount consumed stays the same, increasingly is not true. Because again, you're not looking at political leadership and culture, which matter. The canceling of that project, what Obama said in that speech, similar to Biden putting the recent moratorium on LNG, has reverberations around the world. Oh, well, if he's doing it, maybe we should do it too. Oh, this is a new norm for climate policy. And that empowers institutions to start looking objectively at whether or not fossil fuel infrastructure is in line with climate. So again, it's a norm shift towards recognizing that, oh, actually, we're supposed to be constraining production in line with climate goals as well as demand. How does that work? So it's a pebble in a pond that has an impact far greater. But another point that I wanted to make when we talked about Alberta, one of the things that I realized is that this is the wealthiest industry in the world, right? Throughout history, the oil and gas industry has made $2 billion a day, every day for the last 50 years. So they will swamp every process. And that's what they've been doing to ensure that they get access, that they get their new infrastructure, that they get now support for their carbon capture and storage delusional plans, that this can somehow save us, that they can decouple emissions from production, reduce the amount of emissions, even though production can rise. And that delusion is one of the things I learned in the oil patch when I spent several years as the co-chair of the Alberta Oil Sands Advisory Working Group. I learned that there are really good people who work in the fossil fuel industry, and they're good people and they're stuck in bad systems, and that they have kind of moved from a denial of climate change to a delusion and a faith in technology that is blind, because the data is very clear that those technologies are not working and will not work at scale and are not cost competitive compared to other solutions that do exist, like renewable energy and energy efficiency and electrification. But they're ideologically so focused on figuring out a way to keep their cake and eat it too.
Did you ever talk to individuals, rank and file or others, who say like, who expressed doubt, who maybe thought like, wow, maybe we are trapped in this fool's system, or we're telling ourselves a story to justify our continued existence and job, et cetera. Do you ever have people who came to your side?
No, all the time. All the time. Yes. I mean, so there are a number of people who've worked in the industry that have left the industry and have contacted us wanting to work on the treaty or wanting to work on various pipeline campaigns. And certainly there are people who still work in the industry who contact us saying, you know, can I provide some information or perspective? And I want to be a bridge. And And I actually followed some of those leads for a while and tried to create some of those bridges. And what I realized is if for people who continue to work in the oil and gas companies, they will always be limited by their job, which requires them to increase profit margins, to increase the bottom line. And these big oil and gas companies are not designed to become distributed renewable energy companies, and they never will. And they never will manage their own decline. That's the mistake that we've made in including them in negotiations and in designing policy, et cetera. And that's why governments need to regulate the phase out of fossil fuels.
And you have family, I believe, who work in the tar sands. How do you navigate those relationships? And do they feel you're targeting their livelihood with this treaty? Are they in that camp you just described?
Not only my family, but a lot of people that I've talked to in the oil sands would like to be working other jobs. I mean, these are dirty products. These are dirty jobs. They threaten people's health. They threaten people's lives. They're often jobs that are remote for weeks on end where they're torn away from their families. These are hard jobs. And so would they like to be working in a different industry, a cleaner industry, a safer industry? Would they like to not go home and have their kids say, hey, we're living in a climate emergency and you're making it worse? These are hard times, and we need to have empathy and we need to have compassion. But we can't afford to slow down the transition, because it will happen. It will happen as a managed or an unmanaged decline. And so I just have been trying to use language when I talk to people about the need to create a plan, about the need for all of us to work together and not to be pointing fingers. One of the things we see in the polling is that people know. People are experiencing climate change every day in their lives. They know it, and they know it's our responsibility, but they feel like they're alone. They think that they're not part of the majority, but they are. And showing compassion to the people in the industry, and especially to the workers who need a plan for a change, doesn't mean that we shouldn't call out the companies for what they're doing.
Compassion, not villainization for the rank and file workers, while maintaining goals and speed.
That's it. That's all we need to do.
Okay. Compassion at speed. Thank you very much, Zipporah Berman, for coming on Climate One.
Thanks for having me.
That was Zipporah Berman, chair of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is working on next week by subscribing to our newsletter, which also rounds up the biggest stories in the world of climate. Sign up at climateone.org.
Brad Marshland is our senior producer. Our managing director is Jenny Park. Ariana Brocious is co-host, editor, and producer. Austin Colon is producer and editor. Megan Basili is our production manager and producer. Wincy Shada is our development manager. Ben Testani is our communications manager. Jenny Lawton is consulting producer. Our theme music was composed by George Young. Gloria Duffy and Philip Yun are co-CEOs of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs, the nonprofit and nonpartisan forum where our program originates. I'm Greg Dalton.
These are violent criminals, so they're not going to go down easy.
ABC Tuesdays.
Cops! Let's get this done.
Do it!
The Rookie is back.
We have two new rookies starting today.
Howdy.
Being a cop is stressful 24/7.
Every year on the job is different.
And training day.
We have a serial killer at large.
Never ends.
We need an ambulance!
The Rookie. All new Tuesdays on ABC and stream on Hulu.